Welcome to IEEE 1, Module 13, Part 2. We are going to talk about laptops, mainly replacing components today, and how we can replace components, and how to know when components need replacing, and our different options of replacing said components. To review, since a couple people weren't here yesterday, we talked about laptops. We did a whole lot of review on the wireless standards, different ways of wireless communication, and we went through, what else did we cover? A lot of wireless, honestly. Talked about service centers and certifications, talked a lot about how you should check your warranty, and I'm just going to reiterate here that you need to check your warranty before replacing any of these components to make sure that it is okay for you to do so without voiding your warranty. You should also, as I said yesterday, read the terms and conditions of your warranty so you know what's covered. And if you buy an extended warranty, as somebody found out a couple days ago, make sure that the salesperson tells you about the terms and conditions. You might actually want to have the salesperson read you the terms and conditions of an extended warranty to make sure you know what it covers, or have them get you a copy in accessible format. If they refuse to do either of these things, you may not want to buy the warranty because there might be something, they might be trying to pull a fast one, and you don't want that. All right. Any questions on any of that quick review stuff? All right, cool. All right, so can anyone tell me how you might know that you need a new battery?
You get very short usage periods.
Yep, short usage. Another thing that might happen is that you will have... Another thing that will happen is if you accidentally, you know, hit the power or unplug it, if all of a sudden your laptop shuts off, it might be time to take that battery out and give it a look. If the battery's leaking, you just don't even use that battery anymore. You take it off, like, then and there, and you put it in a plastic baggie or something so that battery acid doesn't leak everywhere. Battery goo is probably a better term because they don't actually contain acid, but you still don't want to get it all over. If your battery overheats, you might actually be able to smell smoke, so you don't want that. So if you suspect the battery, you might want to actually take it out and give it a feel. If it feels bulgy, if you feel, as I say, battery goo coming off of it, if you're using it in the laptop and it seems extremely hot or smells strange, or if it just has very short charge times or doesn't work at all, it might be time to replace your battery. You can get replacement batteries through your manufacturer. These are usually pretty expensive, but probably the best way to go. You might not want to trust batteries on eBay because they are more likely to not be exactly compatible or exactly how the manufacturer made them. So you want to try and get one from the manufacturer if possible. And it'll void the warranty if you use non-genuine batteries. you want them to meet or exceed the specifications for the manufacturer. They need to use the same form factor as the original battery. And if you buy these from the manufacturer, you don't even have to worry about the rest of this because you can get a battery that is exactly for this model and they're not going to give you any surprises. voltages, power ratings, and AC adapters must also meet manufacturer specifications. Always follow the instructions provided by your manufacturer when charging a new battery. Some batteries need to be supercharged, charged for a longer period of time than they normally would be. The laptop can be used during an initial charge, but do not unplug the AC adapter. And this is why I wouldn't use it during the initial charge. Put it somewhere safe where you're not going to bump it or do anything, because while using it, you may actually hit that adapter. NiCad and NIMH rechargeable batteries should occasionally be discharged completely to remove the charge memory. When the battery is completely discharged, it should then be charged to maximum capacity, kind of like your first supercharge. And make sure to handle batteries with care. They can explode if shorted, mishandled, or improperly charged. Never seen it happen, but I bet you can go on YouTube and find exploding batteries. Be sure that your charger is designed for the chemistry, size, and voltage of your battery. As I said, maybe buying it from the manufacturer wouldn't go astray, because you won't get any surprises. Remember, batteries are considered toxic and should be disposed of according to your local regulations. So that's about it on batteries. Does anyone have any questions on replacing batteries? Has anyone had any bad replacement experiences or even ever had to replace a laptop battery?
I've had to replace one because it was defective from the manufacturer. The other thing is that lithium batteries, you don't want to get that stuff wet. It may do very unpleasant things. I know lithium is in the pure state will. I don't know about what's in the battery, but I would not get them wet. And I endorse what you say about not buying stuff off of eBay, because we bought some supposedly Apple AC adapters and they weren't.
Yep. You don't exactly know what you're getting off of eBay. So if you're cheap and you want to take that risk, then go ahead. But if you want to make sure it works, don't do it for a customer, whatever you do.
Unless the customer has signed a disclaimer to say that they're happy with that. Plenty of customers over here in Western Australia will be quite happy to pay $30, but make sure they've signed off to say that, you know, that's what they're doing, or make them order it themselves. Don't be responsible for that.
I would say don't get any batteries wet, because it can't do anything good to them.
Probably the other thing to mention, actually, and a lot of people do this, and this isn't necessarily laptop batteries, but certainly don't do it with laptop batteries. It says so in all of the instructions manuals, and not many people read them, but don't carry batteries around in your bum bag or in your handbag or in your pocket unless they are in an insulating material. There are people who've actually set fire to themselves by having a spare mobile phone battery jingling around in their bag, which then shorted off with their keys and turned into a little bag-sized bomb. So don't do it. If you must carry spare mobile phone batteries around, as some of us do, I find the Ziploc sandwich bags work really well for insulating them off from everything, or Tic Tac boxes if they're Nokia batteries.
Oh, it sounds like you guys are as tired as I am. All right, on to docking stations / port replicators, which increase the number of ports on a laptop. A port replicator might contain a SCSI port, a networking port, PS2 ports, and plenty of USB ports and possibly a game port. The docking station will probably have most of the same ports, but it will also be able to connect PCI cards, additional hard drives, optical drives, and floppy drives. Hold on. Mm-hmm. Often, docking stations will have a line-in, which you might not have on your laptops, and a lot of blind people want that for recording things. So that is one way to add a line-in port if you don't have one. Docking stations will make it convenient to connect to an office network and peripherals like a nice set of speakers, a really nice flash monitor, an ergonomic keyboard, all that good stuff. Docking stations, or most docking stations, are designed to give the laptops basically the same capabilities and feel as a desktop. So your docking station is actually going to be a plastic thing that you're going to put your netbook on top of. A lot of port replicators are just basically cables that you plug one end into a USB or some such, and then you've got all of these additional ports on this long cable that come out from it. At least those are the ones I've seen most prevalently. So this is one time where you can buy, depending on your laptop, if it's USB, something from a different manufacturer. Of course, it's still you get what you pay for. You still might get, if you're going to go buy something cheap, you're still going to get something cheap and not so awesome. you have several different connection options provided by a docking station or a port replicator: RJ45, an RJ11 modem, S-Video, TV out, USB 2.0, probably USB 3.0 now on some of them, external monitor, parallel port, high-speed serial port, IEEE 1394 port. Now, guys, what is IEEE 1394?
Firewire.
Absolutely. Stereo headphone output, stereo microphone input. Some docking stations connect to your laptop using a actual port that is located on the bottom of the laptop. Other ones are actually designed to plug into a USB port. The ones that you actually have the port on the bottom actually just snap in, and you have to push a button to actually eject them. most of these can be docked while actually being turned on, and they'll just auto-detect it. The addition of new devices when docking can be handled by using plug-and-play technology. And we all know what plug-and-play technology does. It recognizes and adds components without having to turn off your computer. So, there you go. Many docking stations, as Carrie's saying, you need to actually run a docking station software on your notebook before you can properly eject them. Many of these docking stations are proprietary only and only work with particular laptops, so be sure to check that. But on the other hand, I've seen a lot of universal docks come through lately. If they're USB, a lot of the times they will work with any type of laptop, so do make sure to check that. Make sure that you know the approximate make and model of your laptop so that you can actually check to see if it's going to be compatible with the docking station you want, because they will give a list of compatible laptops usually. Or they'll say universal, which means try your luck and it should work. Any questions or comments on docking stations? Does anyone use a docking station?
I got one comment. When we bought a Toshiba Tekra M2, Gemma had a Tekra M2, the guy actually suggested we bought the docking station, one, because it was a good thing to buy, and secondly, because the docking station was $200 and came with an extra AC adapter, which usually retails for $130. So we ended up only paying like $70 for the docking station and an extra AC adapter. And that came in really handy. So check that out. Sometimes if there is a docking station, usually the charge on the docking station, because the laptop is sitting in the docking station, a lot of them you actually plug the AC charge into the docking station, and some of them will provide you with an extra power adapter. And that can be very nifty when your primary one goes bang.
Anything else about docking stations? All right. Next we'll talk about storage devices, which are supposedly CRUs unless required, unless the warranty requires technical assistance. I disagree. It depends on the actual computer manufacturer Toshiba considers them CRUs because they're easy to get at in Toshiba computers. I wouldn't call an ASUS hard drive necessarily a CRU because you've really got to get in there. It's like the How to Clean Your Laptop Fan song, if anyone's actually heard that. There are several options for adding or replacing storage devices for a laptop. We've got external USB hard drives, FireWire hard drives, any of these, Blu-ray burners, CD burners, all of these can be external. The form factor... the form factor of an internal hard drive or storage device is actually smaller in a laptop than for a desktop. Okay, Kara's got a gotcha for that apparently, but we'll come back to it. Traditional hard drives are magnetic. These drives have motors designed to spin magnetic platters, which are read by movable drive heads. How many times have we seen that in these chapters? You can also get SSD drives that do not have moving parts, and because there are no moving parts, the SSD uses less energy than the magnetic hard drive, so much more power conservation there. Well, according to this, and you'll see it in your test, it uses less power.
Interestingly enough, and if the test asks you, yes, SSDs use less power. Apparently, Tom's Hardware and a whole lot of other people did some benchmarks, PCMag and stuff, and actually came to the conclusion that sticking SSDs in your netbooks or notebooks did not significantly increase battery life measurably. So there you have it. The other thing I was going to say about laptop hard drives is if you are taking them out and replacing them, make sure you know exactly what sort of laptop hard drive you're putting in. Is it 7 mils thick, 9 mils thick, or 12 mils thick? There's nothing worse than getting a 500 gig hard drive that's too thick to go in the laptop that you're about to put it in. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt.
So what is the actual norm thickness?
I'd have to go look it up. I think it's 9 mil.
Okay, so the three things that having an SSD results in, according to this, are faster access to data, higher reliability, and reduced power usage. An external USB drive connects to the laptop, funnily enough, using a USB port. Another type of external drive is the IEEE 1394 FireWire hard drive that connects to a FireWire port. You won't see many of these on Windows, or get many of these on Windows computers. Some people use them, but they aren't used very often. Why not?
It's not really faster than USB.
It actually is. The reason is it didn't really catch on because it is a proprietary Apple standard and they charge a lot of money to make for others to use FireWire and make FireWire devices.
In the real world, I'll second Brian. They're not much faster than USB. In fact, they're often slower, even if the actual raw transfer rate is said higher on the box. Actually, USB 2.0 is 480 megabytes per second, and FireWire is 400. So unless you're running FireWire 800, which is a rare beast on a PC indeed, they are actually going to be slower. The other thing that will trip you up is the fact that the default drivers for FireWire in Windows 7, especially for the storage class, are quite crummy. And I've seen a lot of forum threads saying that they're only getting 1 to 2 megabytes per second transfer speed to and from their FireWire drives, so go figure. If they do work for you, good. I would tend to steer away from them personally. I have had them work in the past, but they are certainly less ubiquitous for the PC.
I've actually have a couple of external drives that have both USB, FireWire, and eSATA. Clearly eSATA had the best performance, but FireWire was better on the Mac than the PC, but it was still not measurably quicker than USB 2.0.
Okay.
The primary advantage of FireWire, in case anybody cares, is that FireWire allows what we call isochronous transfers, which means that you get real-time transfer between, say, video cameras, camcorders, and that sort of thing. So it was mostly targeted towards multimedia work. We won't go into a long dissertation on that, but that was the reasoning behind FireWire. And yes, you can get FireWire hubs, which is good to know if you run out of FireWire ports.
Because you usually on a Windows machine only have one. And welcome back, Aiden.
You actually have two, Grace. You've got one inboard and you've got one external. If we wired up the inboard one, you would get access to the second one. But hey, I don't see... We've got a little bit of FireWire gear here, but I usually wire it up via USB. If you guys have got a choice, though, I would strongly recommend eSATA. Not only is it faster and more efficient, it also allows the smart information to be passed through to the hard disk, so you can actually tell when your hard drives are failing with things like HDD health. So if it's an option for you, I'd strongly recommend it.
Okay. We've got optical drives. Funnily enough, they read and write optical media. They can read and write data to CDs, DVDs, or Blu-ray, depending on your drive. Okay, we got this. This is a convenient method of creating backups and archiving data. Well, now we have external hard drives and network servers, so not as convenient as it once was.
I was reading the help on Windows Backup the other day, and they said if you've got a DVD drive, by all means use DVDs, although it will tend to be more time-consuming and stuff. It's probably also worth mentioning that there's a statistic that says that something like 40 to 50% of external drives fail 6 to 9 months into their lifespan. Whether that's because a user's knocked them off the desk or something else has horrible happened to them, it probably actually pays to have a bit of removable media and an off-site backup if you can. I mean, the hard drives are more efficient and faster to back up to, but certainly more prone to failure. Anybody here had an external drive fail on them?
Oh, yeah.
I dropped my iPod on concrete and it didn't fail, and it was a hard drive-based one.
You'll get away with that once or twice, and then the third time when you really have a 27-hour bus trip ahead of you and you drop it, it will stop working. It may have actually had a bad sector that you haven't come across on it yet. So be aware that you might sort of fill it up to, you know, 30 gig full and it'll go patonk, 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 and you'll remember that concrete incident. You're lucky when they do survive.
I don't plan to drop it. I just thanked every deity in the book.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, it's really funny, because you'll talk to people, and they'll be telling you about this hard drive problem, and you'll ask them, when did it start? And then they'll think back, and they'll realize they dropped it, or kicked it, or disconnected it in some very violent way, and then suddenly it didn't work. And it's like, I didn't think it had anything to do with that. I'm like, well, yeah, think again, because it did. We've got DVD-R writable. And DVD-R readable and DVD-R rewritable. Before purchasing a new storage device, check the laptop documentation or website of the manufacturer for compatibility requirements. Most USB drives will be compatible with most laptops as long as they have enough power. Documentation often contains frequently asked questions or FAQs that may be helpful. It's also important to research known laptop compatibility issues on the internet. So if you found the CD or DVD drive of your dreams, you might put in a Google search with that and your laptop name to make sure that there is not a million forum posts on one horrible issue that if you, you know, spent the $50, $70 on the drive, you wouldn't wish you had done that. So good thing to check first. on most laptops, depending on the laptop really, the storage devices are connected behind a cover on the underside of the case. But on some laptops, the keyboard must be removed to access these drives. At that point, I wouldn't call it a CRU anymore. because it's probably beyond most customers' capabilities to actually replace that.
Has anyone tried doing the hard drives in the Aspire 1? If you thought the Asus was bad, you've basically got to poke screwdrivers through holes in the back of the case once you've removed the other almost invisible screws and pop the keyboard up from the bottom, trying not to snap all the clips off it while singing your favourite praise to your favourite deity. Some of this stuff gets quite involved.
It's important to know that just because you have a CD drive in your laptop, you might not be able to go out and get that funky new Blu-ray drive. You want to make sure that your laptop is actually going to be able to support that drive before you actually go out and get it. To confirm installed storage devices, you can check the BIOS screen in post. Another way to mostly confirm it is to go into Device Manager and have a look in there. It's accessible, and it works better, but the BIOS might see more devices and be able to do more with the devices than the Device Manager will. If you're going to install a second hard or optical drive in a laptop, make sure that the proper confirm that the proper installation in Device Manager. We've got paths to get into Device Manager. If you need them, look them up in this section of the text. Scrolling. All right, that's it. Any other questions on replacing CD or hard drives or any of that? You get a worksheet here comparing internal and external CD drives, so you'll get to do some research on that.
Anyone still awake?
Yep.
Cool.
Oh, good. I'm barely there. I had to get up at 7 this morning. All right, the next thing we're going to talk about is adding additional RAM, which improves performance by increasing the number of times the operating system reads and writes data to the hard drive swap file. No, that's decrease. Anyway. Yeah, decreasing. All right. It also helps the operating system to run multiple occasions more efficiently.
It's probably worth mentioning at this point that the XP diehards amongst us, I put my hand up in this category, should also be aware that if you do put bog loads of RAM into your laptop, Windows 7 will manage the extra RAM more efficiently by default than XP will.
In some laptops, it says in most laptops, I disagree again here, the graphics processing is actually done by the CPU rather than its own GPU. Not so much anymore. They're starting to put GPUs on video cards now. But the video processing will probably need extra RAM. New applications such as video sharing and video editing require increased performance from laptops. This RAM can help increase laptop performance, as we said.
It's probably also worth mentioning that a lot of laptops are shipping with the Intel graphics hardware, and the Intel graphics hardware does tend to use system memory as frame buffer. It's not hard allocated as it used to be, but it still is pulled out of system memory. It's usually the gaming laptops and stuff that have the GPUs on them. And in fact, our computers that we're using at the moment, they actually pull memory out of system memory for video. So it is becoming more common, but luckily less problematic.
Your make and model of your laptop determines the type of RAM chip needed. Hey, talk to your manufacturers, guys. They can sell you some RAM chips and it'll be the right one, which is really important because you don't want to buy that nice expensive little piece of RAM that doesn't fit your laptop. It's important to get the correct memory type that is physically compatible with the laptop. Most desktop computer uses memory that fits into DIMM slots. This will not work in your laptop. It's too big. Your laptop uses a smaller profile memory chip called a small outline DIMM or SODIMM. They can be ideal for use in laptops because they are smaller. They can also go into printers. When replacing or adding memory, determine if the laptop has available slots to add memory, and that the laptop actually supports the quantity and type of memory to be added, because some netbooks only support 2 gigs of RAM, so that's all you're going to be able to put into it, even if you do have an extra slot. Before you purchase and install additional RAM, consult your documentation or go to your manufacturer's website for form factor specifications.
Also, I was going to say, KingMax has a memory finder site, so does Kingston. And in fact, if you use Kingston's memory finder to find memory for your laptop or the other memory finders, often the memory company will warrant it to work with your laptop, so that's a good thing to be doing.
Yes, absolutely. You don't buy the RAM off of eBay. Such a bad idea. To find where to install the RAM on the laptop, you want to actually look at the documentation. On a lot of laptops, most of them, you'll be able to flip it over. On the back there will be a cover, and you can open up that little cover and put in your RAM. Have fun, because some of this RAM you install on an angle, which can be quite difficult to do. We were working on a student's computer, and I was showing her how to put in RAM, and we actually didn't get it in right the first time because it was on such a strange angle. On some laptops, not as many anymore, you need to remove the keyboard to access the RAM slot. As I said, this is no longer a customer replaceable unit, if that is the case, in my opinion. Remember, as we've said, when we take apart laptops, remove the battery, remove the power, remove the peripherals, so that we don't have any electrical damage, because RAM is quite a sensitive part. Once you've installed the RAM, they say you can check the BIOS or system properties. We're going to check the system properties to make sure that that RAM is installed. And if your JAWS all of a sudden tells you you need a new authorization, chances are you did it right. Any questions on adding RAM?
I'm sure nobody here is unfamiliar with this, but be aware that if you are going to do upgrades on vision-impaired people's computer systems that are running JAWS, make sure they're not out of authorization requests or reset counts before you make the hardware modifications. There's nothing worse than invalidating somebody's JAWS install because they've never ever done an auth reset. Also be aware that as far as we know, when you do a reset these days, you only get one extra install count. Arr, it must be that all us blowing people are pirates or something. But this is quite annoying, so make sure that you get your hardware profile stable before you actually, authorize JAWS and do this sort of stuff. Because I actually have had situations where people have been unable to work effectively because they weren't able to reauthorize their JAWS after hardware upgrades.
I have a remark on that.
Correct. You do get one now.
What's your remark?
Last week I updated from JAWS 11 to 12 on a laptop, and strangely enough, when I restarted the machine, it said that JAWS was authorized to run on a older operating system or older version of JAWS or something, and I lost a reset count because of that.
Fantastic.
I think we all know that the authorization scheme for JAWS has its challenges. There are plenty of systems where if you change any of the Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or other peripheral devices, you will mess your authorization count. And apparently, if you talk nicely to Freedom, they will actually authorize the 3 or 4 different reset codes you need to have all combinations functional. It's just a bit inconvenient that you actually have to sit and do that and then convince tech support that that is what you actually need. NVDA, anyone?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, I'm working with it now to learn it.
Yep, so are most of us. All right. Do we want to talk about preventative maintenance of laptops, or do we want a quiz? What would you guys like?
I'll take a quiz. We've done preventative maintenance many, many times.
Fair enough. Well, I just thought I'd offer because we do have time to do it today in case anyone wanted it. All right. I will make my Braille display actually work, and I will we'll do a quiz, and we'll have a short lecture today because I'm seriously so tired, and I'm sure a lot of people are who went to that.
I got stuck at a customer's place. Is it actually going to go up in Thursday chats or somewhere?
Yeah, it will. Grace has just accidentally shut down Ventrilo. She'll be back on in a moment. And yes, it will go up. It needs some editing because the sensitivity wasn't set optimally on the AutoVox, and I'm leaving that to the person who's produced the podcast to sort that out, and then they can put up with what they're happy, and when it goes up, it will be on announce. So,
I went and gave somebody a new monitor, but that had a bunch of inputs, and of course, it doesn't select VGA by default. So we played with buttons for a while until we finally, by guessing, got the right input to work.
Ah, that's always fun. Grace is restarting. She'll be back presently. There's one thing I like about new machines, and that is that our machines have a boot time from power on to desktop of about 7 seconds. Okay, Grace has a Braille display. Have you had funny problems, Brian, with... Well, specifically ALVA displays, but displays in general not coming up after you come out of standby?
Yeah, I have had that. Not specific to ALVAs, with a bunch of them. particularly with JAWS, more than, let's say, NVDA or other ones, where when you come out of standby, you just get nothing out of it, or do you get sort of dots but no response from your screen reader? Like, does the power come back on, or do you just get a sort of flat display?
I get a flat display. It's like there's something wrong with the power. It doesn't shut the power down quite right on the Braille display, and the Braille display gets mixed up.
Is it a BC640 per chance?
It's a satellite.
Oh, okay. I have one of those at home. I will poke about on 7 with what chipset on
it
the
worked
motherboard. I've seen weird things with certain chipsets where the power resumption isn't quite right.
Yeah, that's what's seeming to happen here. Like, I used to sometimes have a flat display and just completely mess up very rarely, about once every 10 times, but in that case, the screen reader wouldn't respond, and it would completely bungle up the entire thing.
I think the problem is when you come out of standby, there's a lot of things that are happening, and there's no synchronicity as to what's going to happen in which order. When Grace's latches up good and proper, you've actually got to physically disconnect the USB and replug it. That's the only way to take power completely away from the display, and then when it's really bad, you relaunch JAWS. So it's certainly something getting stuck, and the power transition's being a bit odd.
You turn it off, you unplug it, then you turn it back on and plug it in, and if you're lucky, your computer will recognize it.
This is going to sound entirely nonsensical, but if USB is in your boot order in the BIOS, sometimes I've seen turning it off make a difference to that.
Oh, fair
okay.
Enough.
In her case, it's not, but we will certainly triple check.
Yes, it
that.
Is.
No, it's not. No, because the Asuses don't remember the devices properly with USB boot, so you can't reliably turn it on and have it work, because it won't actually put the USB at the right order in the boot sequence. Chris and I were already talking about this. We've got that sorted. We don't have USB in the boot sequence.
We'll chat after lecture, because there's things with chipsets, and it'll take me some digging to remember what I did, but I've come across this before.
Okay, cool. We've got fairly new boards, so Grace did uninstall Asus iCharger, which seems to have improved the situation, but it is a funny situation. I have one where if I plug my hub in, my whole computer won't power up, so it's even more critical. So watch out for that, guys. If you're messing with USB, it can be a fun journey down compatibility lane.
I do. I'm just pulling it up. Chapter 13 quiz. And we're reading it straight from the flash, which shouldn't actually really be too much of a problem, because this computer is pretty fast, but we don't actually have, I haven't actually pulled the quiz out for this, because I didn't think we were actually going to get there today. All right, select the correct answer. Which IEEE specification defines WPN technology? 802.3.1, 802.5.1, 802.7.5, or 802.11.1. Yep, I think A is actually right. All right, next question. Which acronym refers to the name given to laptop parts that can easily be replaced by end users? Is it A, CRU, B, FRU, C, NRU, or D, SRU? Choose now. Hey, and we're all right with A. Fantastic. All right, question number three. This is going to be a yes or no. Select all choices that apply. Which two battery characteristics must be considered when choosing a replacement for a laptop? So it's going to be choose two. Is it A, brand? Okay, how about charging time? That'd be no. Both of those are no. How about color? No, doesn't really matter, except to you, really, unless it's really garish and ugly and people, you know, say, wow, you've got a pink battery and a white
laptop.
Unless
you're female. It tends to matter to females generally more than males what color something is. In fact, color can be a critical purchasing decision.
Usually isn't, though. How about size? We'll take the U as a Y and say, yes, that is absolutely correct. How about voltage? Absolutely, voltage is absolutely right. Which IEEE specification defines the FireWire standard? Is it 1284, 1294, 1384, or 1394? Choose now. And D is absolutely right.
Quick non-quiz question that Grace doesn't have. Can anybody tell me what 1284 is?
I think it's parallel?
More information? No, we're not getting any more information. It's actually parallel. It's bi-directional parallel. And it's very important for modern printers so that Windows can see what sort of printer you've got.
Hey, we've already asked that question. Sometimes this decides it's not going to go to the next question for me, so I've got to click the next button again. All right, so this will be a select multiple options question. Which two materials are recommended for use when cleaning a laptop? Choose two. Diluted ammonia. No, absolutely not. Compressed air? Absolutely. Cotton balls. No, because those are as full of lint as you can get. Detergent? No, we don't need your computer having suds coming out its fan. And isopropyl alcohol. Yes. Our other choice is mild cleaning solution, but we've got our two, so... All right, select two. Which two Windows utilities can be used to help maintain hard disks on computers that have had long periods of normal use? Choose two. Disk cleanup? Absolutely. Disk maintenance? That's a no. Disk partition? Nope. Disk format? No, that'll make it just too squeaky clean. Or disk defragmenter? Absolutely. Which technique does Bluetooth use to reduce the chance of multiple devices interfering with each other? Is it A, D, DNS. B, ISM. C, AFH. Or D, PAN. The answer is C. It is AFH, adaptive frequency hopping. PAN is a personal area network, which is actually the network of little Bluetooth devices that you have around you. So the AFH is actually what is used. All right, multiple answer here, guys. Yes or no? Which two types of external connections on a laptop will automatically detect a connected hard drive? Choose two. PATA? That's right. PATA is a no. FireWire? Absolutely. SSID? IEEE 1294? Those are both no. And USB. Absolutely. Good job, guys.
I'm not actually sure about 1294. I had an old iOmega zip disk, and it knew when it was attached.
That's a parallel. Parallel won't do it.
There's actually probe code in Windows where it will actually probe the parallel port. And as far as I know, all zip disk units actually use a parallel to SCSI bridge chip, if they're the parallel versions. And they all do support 1284. They are all bi-directional.
Okay. A customer... Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's irrelevant. Keep going.
Okay. A customer's laptop has a short operating time when using a battery. What can the technician do to solve the problem? Upgrade the RAM. B, replace the battery. Remove and replace the CMOS battery. Or replace the laptop power supply. Choose now. And your answer is B, pardon me. They can replace the laptop battery. And let's see, is that it? No. Which Windows Vista tool is accurately described? Disk cleanup cleans the hard drive by placing files in adjacent clusters. Disk defragmenter is meant to be used when a computer has files that are modified, added, or deleted often. Disk cleanup performs tasks such as emptying the recycle bin, checking for missing applications, and verifying hard drive cluster's integrity. Disk defragmenter provides a list of files that are the most fragmented, an estimated time to repair, and checkboxes to enable and disable defragmentation. So choose now. This is an interesting one. I would go with B. The disk defragmenter is meant to be used on computers where files are added, modified, and deleted.
No, C.
No?
Yeah, Microsoft's tech documentation actually states that excess defragmentation can shorten the life of drives, and that by default NTFS should not require frequent defragmentation. C is truer.
It doesn't check for missing applications or verify hard disk cluster integrity. This is disk cleanup. So disk cleanup performs tasks such as emptying the recycle bin. Yes, it does. Checking for missing applications. No, it doesn't. And verifying hard drive clusters integrity. No, it doesn't.
Okay, we'll go with
so
B. Badly
C
written question
true.
As usual.
Yep. A customer is unable to use a laptop on battery power for more than 30 minutes. What would a technician suggest to this customer? Gee, this looks familiar. A, flash the BIOS, replace the power supply, replace the laptop battery, or replace the laptop motherboard. Yeah, see, didn't we seriously see this two questions ago in a slightly different form? I think we did, so...
They're taking lessons from our social security. ask the same question in two different ways and see how many of the population you can fool. Do you have children? Yes, no. How many children do you have?
Okay, what could be the probable cause of a laptop making a long beeping noise if a new RAM is installed? The RAM is being formatted? Hot swappable RAM was installed? A damaged SATA module was installed? There is a communication conflict between the BIOS and the RAM. I'd go with C.
They forgot the most important choice. Maybe it's not all the way in.
Yeah. That'd be my guess, and that's happened to me a couple of times. Not with laptops, but with desktops.
It has happened to you with laptops?
Oh, yeah. But we didn't get the long beeping noise. We just didn't see the RAM.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
You normally don't get a long beeping noise with netbooks and stuff because the PC speaker circuitry isn't accessible until the sound card is initialized. But, yeah, we usually just get a blank screen on netbooks.
Okay, guys, we finished the quiz. Yay! Does anyone have any questions on anything in this module or previous modules or any labs or anything they want to review?
I have a question on a lab that I had sent you yesterday. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it.
Not yet, but we can talk about it.
Okay, it was the one with the one I was having trouble with the log event thing. Okay. I think I got it sorted out, and I sent it to you. I just wanted to, you know if I was right with it.
Okay. Yeah, you probably were. I'll have a look. What you do is you go into the event log and you press. You look at the details of the event, because it's not actually going to tell you which event in the title. You completely can't tell with JAWS. So you actually have to go into the event and look at it, and look at the find the four events and say, oh, there they are. And you copy them out and paste them in there, and it's all good.
Yeah, I think the error number was like 7040, if I'm not mistaken.
The
event number.
Okay. I'll have a look. If not, I can help you find them. You just do it, and the best thing you can do is do it and then you go into the event viewer right away after you do it, so you'll have less events to actually look through.
Okay, that's all I needed.
Problem. I don't actually know the specific event number that it would be, but I can tell you, I know which events should be there. She was here for the word demonstration. She's probably going back to bed. Anyone else have anything they need assistance with or on or any of that?
Gentle reminder, people, course officially finishes... when's your official course finish date?
28th of January. So if you need to re-enroll or any of that, let us know. Or if you need any help with labs, let us know. We are here to help you, except not right now because I'm going back to bed because I feel like I've been run over by something.